You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Jonah Chester. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, June 26th, 2018.
But you also brought the booze, Jay.
I did bring the booze.
He was working as a service bartender at Mark Pye's China Gate, and he had stolen a tremendous amount of liquor.
Later in the program, we'll hear from Joe Nickel and Bart Everson, the producers of J&B on the Rocks, the first television program on the internet that started in a basement in Bloomington. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Trina Sterling talks about the history of the John Waldron Arts Center in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
The Monroe County Republican Party is holding their party caucus tomorrow. The caucus will take place in the Monroe County Courthouse at 6 p.m. Party members are invited to vote for four vacant election positions ahead of this fall's midterm elections. Party Chair William Ellis says tomorrow's caucus is expected to take a voice vote to confirm uncontested candidates for currently vacant election positions.
There's contested people on the ballot for the caucus. There'll be a vote. Usually, you know, it's the secret ballot. But in this case, there's no contested one, so we'll just take a voice vote. If there's one affirmation that this person's on the ballot, then I sign some paperwork and that's it. They're on the ballot.
Ellis says there are currently only four applicants running to fill party vacancies, but he's hoping for the possibility to fill a fifth vacancy during tomorrow's caucus.
We might be able to fill a fifth one, depending on how things go on the caucus with the caucus. There may be a fifth that comes on board.
Ellis says the Monroe County Republican Party is looking for feedback from its constituency. Ellis is asking area Republicans to reach out to the county party and get involved in party politics.
I encourage any Republicans listening that if you're not happy or happy with the way the party's going locally, get involved either way. Because as chairman, I only hear from the same people regularly. I'm more than willing to solicit input, but I need to hear from you. And we'll be at the Monroe County Fair here in a week or so. Stop by the booth. I'll be there most days. But get involved with your community, either at the precinct level or, just get involved with activities that we have at our page, MonroeCOGOP.com. There's a place to volunteer there. But I'd like to hear from everybody because it's not my Republican Party, it's theirs.
Meanwhile, the Monroe County Democratic Party held a caucus on Monday, during which they confirmed Ashley Pirani to fill a vacancy to run against incumbent Republican council member Marty Hawk. Hawk has been involved on and off again in county politics since 1988. The Ellettsville native has served six full terms as a county council member, primarily for the county's third and most western district. Both parties have until this Saturday to fill candidate vacancies.
The Indiana Center for Recovery is appealing a fire code violation it received in late May. The for-profit addictions treatment company narrowly received a variance request from the city to move patients into a former apartment complex on West 1st Street by the IU Health Bloomington Hospital. A state inspection by a fire marshal and a City of Bloomington fire inspector found the Indiana Center for Recovery in violation of its use permit in May. The Herald Times reports the addictions treatment company filed its appeal a day before their compliance deadline. Earlier this month, Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton's office announced that they would seek a moratorium on new addictions treatment facilities in the city limits. Backlash from area organizations, including the Indiana Recovery Alliance, quickly put a stop to that proposal. The mayor's office announced they would withdraw the proposal on June 8th. A new opioid addiction treatment center opened in Bloomington last week. Limestone Health on the city's west side is one of five privately operated methadone treatment centers green-lighted by state officials.
The Indiana Supreme Court ruled last week that students must be read their rights if police are present. WFHB correspondent Jonah Chester reports.
Last Wednesday, the state Supreme Court ruled that students being questioned in schools must be read their Miranda rights. The court justices unanimously agreed that students who are being interrogated by school administrators are owed Miranda rights if there are police present at the interrogation. In a companion ruling, the court unanimously determined that if there are no police present at the interrogation, the student is not owed their Miranda rights. Those rights include the right to remain silent and the right to an attorney. The state Supreme Court decision concerns a case where two students graffitied bomb threats on the walls of a Decatur Middle School boys' restroom 2 years ago. After the incident, the boys were brought in for questioning by school administration. One, named DZ in court documents because he's a minor, was taken by the principal for questioning, and the other, labeled as BA in the documents, was brought into a room with Decatur Middle School's vice principal and three school resource officers, who reportedly encouraged him to confess to the threatening graffiti. Both boys confessed to vandalizing the restrooms. The court held that, given that there were three officers in the room during his questioning, BA's constitutional rights were violated. The state Supreme Court ruled that any elicited confession with school resource officers present would have legal impacts on the juvenile. Therefore, the court determined that the interrogation was a violation of his constitutional rights and suppressed any confession given during the 15-minute interview. In DZ's case, however, the court held that since there were no police officers present during his interrogation by Decatur's principal, he was not owed his Miranda rights. The court upheld the lower court's ruling of criminal mischief. Writing for their unanimous decision, Supreme Court Justice Loretta Rush wrote that, quote, "Miranda warnings protect students, no less than adults at a school, when police place them under custodial interrogation. Custodial interrogation, though, requires police involvement. So when school officials alone meet with students, a clear rule governs. Miranda warnings are not required," unquote. Monroe County Schools Assistant Superintendent Andrea Mobley says that the court's ruling will not change disciplinary policies at MCCSC schools.
MCCSC currently follows the standards that have been set forth in the recent court cases. In situations where the local law enforcement does come into the school and an officer wants to question a student about something that has happened in regards to an alleged illegal activity, the officers always read the students the Miranda rights. And of course, if the student is a minor, which most of our students are, the parents are or guardians are present for that as well, and then they have a chance to speak privately before the officer would question them about anything.
Mobley adds that the resource officers used by MCCSC schools also undergo an additional 40 hours of training compared to other officers.
MCCSC currently employs one school resource officer for the corporation who is trained in law enforcement along with the extra required 40 hours of training as a school resource officer. That is because we know that working in a school requires a certain set of expertise that may be a little bit different than a traditional police officer working on the street.
School resource officers in the state of Indiana are law enforcement agents placed in schools to maintain student safety. For WFHB, I'm Jonah Chester.
State officials are broadening their Silver Alert requirements. Currently, Indiana's Silver Alert, which is a public alert system for missing persons with mental disabilities, only applies to individuals with mental impairments who are 18 years or older. Missing endangered children will be included in Indiana's Silver Alert program when Indiana House Bill 1248 becomes law on July 1st. The bill defines a missing endangered child as a missing child who is incapable of returning to the missing child's residence because of physical or mental incapacities. According to January report by the State House file, the bill has its origins in a partnership between Indiana State Representative Sharon Neagle and Jennifer Dawson, a mother whose teenage autistic son wandered away from a care facility in 2016. Because he had left on his own free will, Indiana's missing child notices did not apply to him. The House bill will officially become law this Sunday, July 1st.
The state of Indiana is seeking public input on newly proposed child support guidelines. The Domestic Relations Committee of the Judicial Conference of Indiana is looking for public comment on a new set of guidelines for child support. The committee's guidelines dictate how members of the state's judiciary make decisions on issues such as child support in divorce cases and paternity cases. Residents can submit comments online through August 27th or attend a public hearing on August 17th in the Supreme Court courtroom in the State House.
City of Bloomington Utilities plans to demolish its old Griffey Lake water plant. Capital Projects Manager Mike Hicks told the utility's service board last night a recent investigation revealed asbestos at the plant.
There are floor tiles and the mastic that sticks them. They're about 35 cubic feet of that material. There's about 1,700 linear feet of insulation wrapped around pipes in the plant that needs to be removed. And all this prior to the larger contract to demolish the structure.
The Griffey Water Treatment Plant was built in 1925 but went out of use in 1996. Veet Environmental conducted the asbestos investigation. Hicks assured Commissioner member Jason Bonnack that the investigation was thorough and all the asbestos will be removed.
Yeah, with the asbestos ones, I mean, it's been my experience, not here, but other places, that they tend to, oh, wow, guess what? We ripped this up and found more, and now it's going to be an add-on. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad to hear you say that we're confident this includes all the asbestos in the building.
About 700 linear feet of the pipe wrap was above ceilings and not exposed, and we tore out enough ceiling to be able to measure that. And so there weren't any areas, I don't believe it, you know, we couldn't see exactly what's there.
The Utilities Service Board approved contracting with SSI Services for the asbestos removal and disposal. In his report to the board, Utilities Director Vic Kelson reported the collapse of two underground culverts.
If you've been out on West Kirkwood today, you'll notice we have it closed out there where we're repairing where a culvert partially collapsed in the eastbound lane of West Kirkwood some weeks ago. That work is expected to take 3 days. We hope to be done by the end of Wednesday.
Kelson said utilities engineers are working on a fix for another culvert collapse, this one under a parking lot at Wiley and Walnut Streets. The next Utilities Service Board meeting takes place on July 9th. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Jonah Chester. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
The second season of J&B on the Rocks saw producers Joan Nickel and Bart Everson interview Noam Chomsky, load fruit with alcohol, and light up a joint on the Monroe County Courthouse Square, an act that landed them in hot water with statewide conservative organizations and garnered national media attention. The Bloomington-based J&B on the Rocks was the first television series on the internet, and its grungy production quality was a backlash against sleek and overproduced mainstream television programs of the time, including My So-Called Life and the first season of Friends and ER. J&B sit down with WFHB News Director Wes Martin to talk about Rocks Season 2, Life Since 1994, and tonight's special at the Comedy Attic in downtown Bloomington.
We ended up doing something that's kind of was reality television before reality television was a thing. So in the early 90s, the only other reality television was Cops, right? Which is so different from reality television today, where it's basically just game shows, you know, game show competitions with without a script,
yeah.
Right? But we were shooting without a script, and you know, by the time we get into the second season, we had figured out that we could roam around with the camera, roam around through Bloomington, and not just have a talk show format, but try to look at different aspects of our lives here, and without a script. So we were just shooting a bunch of video and then trying to edit it together into something resembling a coherent narrative.
So let's take a step back. Could mm-hmm. both of you introduce yourselves?
I'm Jay. I'm your bartender.
And I'm B. I'm the editor for this program. It is a television program, an independently produced television program that we've been making really since 1992. We started off in a basement here in Bloomington, Indiana.
On Cottage Grove.
Yeah, just a couple of drunken fools ranting at the video camera. And we kind of progressed a little bit through three seasons of intensive production here in the early to mid-90s in Bloomington. And we're producing a weekly show. And we ended up doing that like a traditional television show of having half the year on as the season. And then half the year off, we would just take a break.
Although we would still run the video camera, so we were collecting footage all that time, just not necessarily producing shows per se.
Right, but that pace of trying to put out a new television, a new usually half-hour television show every week on Tuesday nights on the cable access station was incredibly ambitious in retrospect because...
Foolish.
When we
did it.
Yeah, we finally, we racked up all these episodes in these first 3 years, and then we just hit the wall and went on a long hiatus. But we're still in production now. We got back in production some time ago.
Really?
And we just finished episode 99, in fact. It aired here on cable last weekend for the first time. I think it may have run a couple times since then. It's called Go Viral or Die Trying.
One, how did you two meet? And then how did you decide to undertake something that is so much work in your free time?
Well, we first met in a class taught at our dorm by Dr. Bonnie Kendall called, I think it was Literature as Anthropology and Anthropology as Literature, which was a high concept class that was fascinating. But then there was this poem that Bart found that he wanted to make a video about. And I'll let you share that, I guess.
Well, it was actually a chapter or a monologue from a book called End Product, which is in the collection here at the library at Indiana University. And I discovered it in a folklore class. The End Product is one of the few books out there that's dedicated to feces. And so there was a monologue in there from the point of view of a human fecal dropping, I guess you would say, who is narrated from his point of view. He's kind of anthropomorphized. His name is Joe. And so since J stands for Joe, actually, I hope I'm not giving away too much. I thought, who do I know who's named Joe? So I got this guy to act in the video.
Joe's turd. And, that's how it all began. That never was actually in the show, though. There was a whole series of pre-show videos that we made. A lot of this also dated back to when I graduated from college in 1991. I graduated here at Indiana University, of course, as did Bart B. My mother gave me a video camera, a little VHS-C format JVC video camera, and we started messing around with it, and we would make these videos. By this time, it was post-college. We were hanging out pretty much every day, either at my place or his apartment. Kind of wasn't a question of whether we would. It was just what we were going to do. So we were making up games a lot and playing those. There was the concept jar, I remember, was a popular one that we used to play with, where we'd just draw ideas out of a jar and draw them or do something with them. And we also, incidentally, before we started the show, we were going to actually start a rap band. So we weren't very grunge at all, as it turns out.
Well, not musically, but the spirit, the independent spirit.
Exactly.
I was just, I discovered the public access station. I was really interested in messing around with a video as a medium to try to insert some kind of message out there, right? To kind of make art and put it out there that people would actually see. Because if it's on your television in your living room, then you're actually going to reach a whole audience that wouldn't see any other kind of art. And so I was chomping at the bit to have access to equipment. You could check out cameras, from the community access station. It was called BCAT at the time, now CATS, Community Access Television Services. Then I realized, when a friend of mine actually had his own video camera, I started trying to use that all the time.
Yeah. You know, so basically, we started. I was involved because I brought the camera, just like B's now wife. Christy Paxson recently pointed out just the other day that she got involved because she brought the car.
Right. But you also brought the booze, Jay.
I did bring the booze.
He was working as a service bartender at Mark Pye's China Gate, and he had stolen a tremendous amount of liquor. So we came up with the idea of making a weekly television show about mixed drinks. And it just seemed like we thought we'd call it Bar Talk. Car Talk, you know, like Tom and Ray Mariotti.
Bela Bar Talk,
But we were worried that people would confuse it with Bela Bar Talk, so we changed the name to J&B on the Rocks and started cranking them out from this basement right here on Cottage Grove in Bloomington. Very low production standards, the lowest of low production standards you can imagine, just a camera mounted on a tripod with a bare bulb hanging from overhead, no microphones usually. A number of mixed drinks, and we were off.
Yeah, but then after what was it, 8 episodes or so, I moved out of that house, and it was actually because we moved out of that house and couldn't find another setting that was as
grungy
and awful, that we just started moving around with the video camera just because nothing else was visually appealing enough. And that sort of took us to that next level of, you know, being a lot more unscripted. Because we at least initially started out, we would have this little list of topics, you know, like postal rates and, you know, a vocabulary word and, you know, just these ideas. And we were trying to get through this list as we got progressively more intoxicated. We rarely did what we planned. And then we just stopped planning altogether for a while, for most of the second season. I think it was toward the end of the second season, actually, which is what we're celebrating here. It was toward the end of that second season that we started getting serious and actually making an episode planning worksheet and kind of collecting ideas. But even that was more improvisational than anything.
So we did go through a series of kind of issues with the access station on what could air and what couldn't.
With Michael White, the
director of the station. You know, he was always trying to keep us out of jail and, of course, the station out of trouble as well. But, you know, we were incredibly bold, I guess you would say, and naive about what could fly and what couldn't. So we found those limits very quickly and kind of got that all taken care of in the first season. By the time we got around to the second season, we had actually kind of started to realize the power and potential of actually going out on a limb and making a statement with something that would be very, you know, out there. And so we started planning this idea of making an episode called J&B Get Baked. And through the entire second season, we were actually planning that we were going to culminate with this episode number 59. We had been planning it for at least 6 months. And we had, again, established that, you know, we weren't going to get in trouble. If we were going to get in trouble, it was going to be for something
that we cared about.
That we cared about, something important, something bigger than just genitalia.
Yeah.
And so you smoked a joint on the steps of the Monroe County Courthouse.
That's correct. Right. Yeah. As a way of making a statement about the racist war on drugs and how we need to end that. We need to stop locking up our own citizens. And we need to stop criminalizing this very human behavior that doesn't really, this victimless crime, and, you know, end the war on drugs.
That was Joe Nickel and Bart Everson, better known as J&B, speaking with WFHB News Director Wes Martin about their release party and fundraiser for WFHB and J&B on the Rocks tonight at 8 at the Comedy Attic. More from that interview can be found online at wfhb.org after this program. Support for WFHB comes from listeners like you and from the IU Health Foundation, where local gifts stay local. Serving patients for a healthier Bloomington.
Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
This is my Monroe County story. I'm Trina Sterling. I work with the Ivy Tech John Waldron Arts Center. The Waldron was built in 1915, and it served the community in three different ways. First as a city hall, and then later as a community arts center, and then now it's a comprehensive community college. The building, when it was first built, it held the mayor's office, the city clerk, the treasurer, the DA, the police department, the fire department, the heating plant, courtroom, and then the council chambers. And when it was first designed, the auditorium was designed to hold like 1,000 people. And then once they had all the architects come in, then they got it down to 500 people. But now the room capacity is 200. When Ivy Tech first moved to the building, we heard a lot of stories from a lot of people who came in and said, this happened, that happened. Everybody was saying it was a jail. So at the time, Chancellor Emeritus sent me out to get the history of the Waldron. And so one of the things I did find that it was not the jail, that the jail was actually adjacent to the building, and there's a little alleyway in between the Waldron and what was the jail. It was designed so the prisoners could be taken from the courtroom over to the jail so they didn't have to go outside at all. And like right now, that space that we use, it's sort of attached to our dressing rooms in our fire bay downstairs. Originally, it was referred to as Lot 91. A man named George Thornton owned the lot. He bought it for $159 from somebody who didn't pay their taxes. After that, then a man named Lewis Anderson, he bought it for like $4,400, and then he turned it over to the city. And this was in like 1910. So about that time, the fire department, their lease was getting ready to expire. So the city decided to build a city hall at that building where it was formerly Lot 91. So then there was controversy in the development of the building. The architect was named John Roydell, and he was from Indianapolis. The contractor was from Indianapolis as well. His name was George Weaver. The stone company was Holy Stone Company, and the stone contractor, his name was Sam DeCroz. The controversy came up because at one point, Frank Waddell and George Weaver determined that the stone was substandard, and so they had to tear down parts of what they'd already built. Sam DeCroz, who was the stone contractor, they were very upset, and so they left town and went back to Ohio, and they lost money on it. So then, after all the controversy, then they got back to work. The first event at the Waldron was the Fireman's Gala in 1916, and it was a dollar admission. That money helped buy a pool table for the fire department, which I believe is still over at the 4th Street Fire Department, the headquarters, and then it helped build them a library and then just sort of a lounge area. The building pretty much remained the same up until 1950. In 1950, they built the fire chief's office adjacent to the city hall, and that now is WFHB. And then in 1972, firemen decided to build a separate space above the fire bay. It included a kitchen and a lounge area, and so the firemen could have a space to relax. And then their sleeping quarters were above the fire bay. In 1963, City Hall moved out, and then at that time, the city clerk's office was converted to the dispatch room, and the auditorium was converted to the police evidence room. And then the police department moved to 3rd Street in 1986. And then fire department stayed until 1994. The BAAC, the Bloomington Area Arts Council, saw this as a really great opportunity to use as an art center. A woman named Rosemary Miller met with Herman Wells, and then he put her in touch with Cecil Waldron. She was the wife of Charles Waldron, who was the grandson of John Waldron, who was a really prominent banker and politician as well here. So the building was named after Cecil, and she donated $375,000 to help the building become an art center.
Tune in next week for part two of this bicentennial story.
Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Andrew McKeering, Jonah Chester, and Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welch, with help from Joyce Poling. Our engineer is Megan Wade. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmidecki, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Jonah Chester.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at wfhb.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin, fairness and accuracy in reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.